Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever in the world you are. This is Basil Valentine in for Patrick Henningsen today, Monday, the 29th of April, 2024. What is it the Bible said about the end times? There will be wars and rumors of wars. Well, we've got at least two wars and rumors of several more. And that's what I'll be discussing with my esteemed guest, Dirk Polman, coming up very shortly. The people of Ukraine want peace, says retired General Harald Kujat. But if you read Foreign Affairs magazine, Europe should be mobilizing for war with Russia. Yes, the crazies are out in force once again, led by our very own Lord Cameron. He's been speaking in Riyadh today at a World Economic Forum event, also attended by Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. They've put a deal on the table for Hamas that apparently includes a 40-day sustained ceasefire. Not sure what a sustained ceasefire is or how it differs from an ordinary ceasefire. 40 days in which Hamas will be required to release all the Israeli hostages it took on October the 7th, and Israel will release thousands of Palestinian hostages it took most of after October the 7th. Hamas under a great deal of pressure to accept the deal, which was described by Tony Blinken as very generous on Israel's part. Right at the epicenter at the moment of the crisis are the imminent arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, and other members of the Israeli war cabinet. It will be extremely embarrassing, to say the least, for the United States and Israel to be allied with people identified even by Karim Khan, the bought and paid for prosecutor at the ICC, people who have international arrest warrants out, meaning they can't leave the country, and the global constitutional crisis will deepen. Furthermore, Israel has threatened that the gloves will come off and that they will only intensify their attacks on Rafah if Netanyahu and his cohorts are indicted. We're at a crucial point in humanity's history right now, and it's only to be hoped that what few wise heads there are on the global stage will prevail and we will have peace and prosperity. Worth noting that David Cameron said that the release of the hostages and the departure of the Hamas leadership from Gaza is an essential prerequisite for the so-called two-state solution. He seems to be blissfully unaware of the fact that such a solution to the Israel-Palestine question has been completely ruled out by the Israeli government and by all the major parties in the Knesset. Unless, of course, the West is prepared to implement the kind of swingeing sanctions on Israel that we saw on South Africa in the 1980s and 90s that eventually led to the collapse of the apartheid regime there. I personally think that's highly unlikely. So quite how this two-state solution is going to come about or where it's going to be, that remains to be seen. I think, as one commentator has said, the United States doesn't support a two-state solution. It only supports hawking about a two-state solution. Meanwhile, more and more people are aware of the fact that the Zionist entity, as it is increasingly known, has to be dismantled in its entirety, and a single state solution with equal rights for everybody, a genuine democracy stretching from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, is the only just long-term solution for the entire region. But for that to happen, there has to be not only a laying down of arms, but a truth and reconciliation process that frankly dwarfs those of Northern Ireland or South Africa. My first guest tonight, as I said, is Dirk Polman, TNT contributor. He'll be joining me shortly to discuss war and peace on the Eastern Front. And then after the news, at the top of the hour, I'll be joined by Brian Hesher-McLean to look at what's happening on American campuses. This is the biggest crisis in the homeland since the Vietnam days, is it not? And then at 10:30 UK time, I'll be joined by Phil Zimmerman to ask and hopefully answer the question, is there such a thing as controlled opposition? Is it indeed a thing, or is it just make-believe on the part of some conspiracy theorists? Anyway, I'm delighted to say, first of all, I'm joined by Dirk Pohlmann, all the way from Germany. Great to have you with us, Dirk. And wow, what a position we're in at the moment globally. Far and away, I mean, you know, it's easy to use sort of hyperbolic language and get carried away. But surely this is the most dangerous moment for all of us since, you know, you or I, and we're not spring chickens, since we've been alive.
Yes, probably that is correct. I mean, I've been alive at the Cuban Missile Crisis already, and I also was alive during, that was 1983. What was that called? Abel Archer, that moment where... I live in former East Germany now, and in East Germany there were the nuclear bombers were with running engines, nuclear weapons under the belly, ready to take off. That was the moment in 1983, so that was dangerous too. But I think in a way it is more dangerous now because it reminds me of 1914, really, where a world war broke out because nobody was eagerly trying to prevent it. It was a slippery slope towards something that created the catastrophe in Europe. And I think it's in a way similar what we're going through now, because I've never seen so many people who shouldn't be in the positions that they are and running the business. So, and you can ask yourself, if you have somebody like the wandering mummy Joe Biden in the United States, or Annalena Baerbock in Germany as a foreign minister, who's really running the show? If these people who don't seem to be on the top of their capabilities are in command, who's really in command? And this is why I think it's dangerous. And then you can see a lot of background noise. It seems that it's kind of a competition who's coming out with the weirdest proposals. It's like a poker game, you could say. Everybody's trying to bluff, and that with nuclear weapons, what could go wrong? Yeah,
absolutely, everything could go wrong. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn, much maligned former leader of the Labour Party, penned an op-ed in The Guardian last week in which he likened the current situation to 1914 and quotes Christopher Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers. The protagonists of 1914 were sleepwalkers, watchful but unseeing, haunted by dreams yet blind to the reality of the horror they were about to bring to the world. Of course, the current situation is arguably 1,000 times more dangerous because although 20 million people died in the Great War, the future of humanity itself and civilization wasn't threatened in the way that it is now by nuclear war. He went on to say that it was a series of missteps, one at a time, that sleepwalked the world into a global catastrophe. I would venture to suggest that at the moment, rather than actually sleepwalking and accidental missteps, there seems to be a very conscious route march towards war, with people describing it as inevitable, encouraging it, you know, demonizing the Russian people for no good reason, seeming to think that somehow a major war in Eastern Europe, perhaps spreading to the rest of Europe, would be a good thing. I find it incredible that the post-war consensus, you know, for which the European Union was founded, the German-Russian post-war peace pact that neither wanted to repeat the horrors of 39-45, was central to German foreign policy. All that seems to have been ripped up in a few short years, Dirk.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't agree more on that. That is as you described it. And it's also, I think there are several things that have to be kept in mind. It's in, for example, in Russia, a quarter of the population vanished in, it's 27 million people, a quarter of the population that was in the war, really. So that is something, and I drove through Russia by car to Grozny, a long trip, 4 weeks, yeah, in 2017. And it was still, if you go from, let's say, what is now Belarusia, Minsk, and go a little bit further towards Moscow, there are still villages where there were no men left at the time of World War II, simply no men in these villages. So these things, I think it's for the Russians, it is always there. What they call the Great Patriotic War is when young people go to marry, they go to the graves of their grandfathers and say basically thank you to their grandfathers that they still exist. So that is, in Germany, it was about 6 million people who perished during World War II. And it's especially the generation that is where some people are still alive, where they are children. So for my mother-in-law, for example, she was every night in the bunker because of the bombing raids and remembered that vividly and said her greatest wish as a child was to sleep for one night through. So so what I want to say is that for that generation, the horror of war was there. And for me as their son and son-in-law, it was from their stories. But I think I talked to several high-ranking military people from Switzerland, which I really, really admire. Also, Harald Kujat is, but he's, if you listen to him, and he was the highest general that Germany had after World War II, and he was head of NATO. And if you listen to him, he's the sane voice of reason. But he's not heard in the mainstream media. You have to go to alternative media or to small magazines like some from Switzerland who regularly interview him, because his approach is that the conflict we're in was preventable and it could have been ended in May 2022. For the Russians, they thought the war would be easier. They considered it to be possible to, obviously, they tried to conquer Kiev in the beginning, although they were going with a very small force. Usually, as a rule of thumb in military strategies, you know that you need to have at least three times as much people if you are the aggressor than the defender. And Russia had only 119,000 soldiers, whereas Ukraine had 400,000 soldiers. So that was clearly, I considered that a proof that there was no intent to conquer all of Ukraine. But they tried something in the beginning in Kiev that didn't work. And that was really the moment when there should have been peace. It would have been the best possible peace for Ukraine as well. And Arestovich, the advisor of Zelensky, said they had already the champagne corks popping from, because they had an agreement. And the agreement was basically that Russia would Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, these areas would still be Ukrainian, but it would be basically like Minsk 1 and 2 agreements that would be instated. And now Russia is talking about, they will talk with Ukraine after they have capitulated. If you look to the military situation, and that's also what Kujat describes, it couldn't be worse for Ukraine. And it couldn't be worse for Europeans, because Ukraine lost 1.5 generations already. It is enormous. It's a meat grinder. It's an enormous amount of bloodshed. And they're running out of bodies to go to the front. People, human beings, which have been killed in enormous amounts, four times as much as the Russians probably have losses. So the problem is that there are no Ukrainians really left. You can send rockets there and all kinds of modern arms, but there are no people left. And in the strategy that we hear from the Western countries, it's not that there is a goal which could be reached by diplomatic negotiations, which usually is the end of a war if there is not an unconditional surrender. But the West, if you have a goal like Annalena Baerbock said, we will destroy Russia by sanctions and other things like that, and military-wise. Or if you have it like Macron said, Putin cannot win. We shouldn't allow him to win. Then what do? You can only escalate. And to what? And now we hear from foreign policy, foreign affairs, not foreign policy, from foreign affairs, from the Council of Foreign Relations. They propose that not NATO, but European countries should be fighting in Ukraine, sending soldiers there, going into war. And the Russians wouldn't mind that really if we stick to air defense, stuff like that. And that's, again, what could go wrong? I mean, this is so insane that I don't know what to say about it. And I would really love to hear that people like Harald Kujat were still in command, but they aren't. And what we hear from our military now is there's a 1,000-page plan handed out now where they ask for support from the population in terms of feeding the soldiers, handing out coffee and milk when they're going through, and getting war ready. This is so, the kind of talk is, I don't know what to say about it. It's insane. And that's exactly what you said with Christopher Clark. This is what I refer to. This book, it should be on the coffee table of all of our politicians. They should read it because you can see how you can stumble into something like this if you don't have enough fear. The last thing I would like to add here is I once did an interview with Thomas Reed, who was the Secretary of the Air Force, and he was a nuclear arms engineer. And he said that people should, he regretted that there are no atmospheric tests of nuclear weapons, because he said anybody who witnessed that, a megaton explosion, knows what we're talking yes. about. It's the enormous brutality of an explosion. And you're sitting there with your black goggles. And then in the moment of the explosion he described to you, you see the bones of the people around you. The light is so strong that it's like X-ray. And once you've seen that, you see the veins, you see the bones. It's like a look through the body. That is so shocking that nobody who ever saw that will forget it. And this is missing. Instead, we have Twitter politicians who are on Twitter and looking to be the smartest asshole in the classroom. Sorry about my language.
Not at all, Dirk. I quite understand. I mean, we all welcome the comprehensive nuclear test ban as a precursor to a safer, cleaner, and ultimately nuclear-free world. But we seem to be heading in the other direction at the moment. We're going to take a short break with the network. When we come back, I'll be asking Dirk about why has German polity deteriorated so sharply in the last 20 years, and why has peace been abandoned as a principle? We'll be right back after this short break.
Los Angeles has been described as a suburb looking for a city. Join me as we explore LA's neighborhoods and the local restaurants, cafes and bars that are an integral part of these vibrant and diverse communities.
Today we are going to cook a small steak for people who are really quite hungry.
Very, very simple. A couple squeezes of lemon in there.
Since you're adding the meat, and you can do it with tofu options as well for the vegetarians.
Olive oil. So now we're gonna season it up. Fresh grind black pepper.
Really hot and busy in here.
I'm gonna go ahead and make some buttered toast.
Olive oil.
Ah, really smells good.
Grab our shiitake mushrooms.
Season with salt a little bit.
Boy, it's getting hot in the kitchen. Need another drink of my beer. Ah, that's the best part of cooking.
And we are ready to put our plate together.
Add the mussels right around the rim.
See, we have really nice colors, nice piece of fish.
We just need to add a little bit of powdered sugar.
And I will just put a little bit of reduction glaze over the top.
When you add a pesto like this onto a braised meat, the smells that just come up are just wonderful. Take it from me, we've got a good thing going here.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies.
No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine. In for Patrick today, Monday the 29th of April. Foreign Affairs is the house journal of the Council of Foreign Relations, the brainchild or plaything, if you like, of the likes of the late Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, and assorted Washington apparatchiks. Jimmy Carter was the first American president to be a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. And now it's pretty much a requirement of anybody who wants to join the elite club of global rulers, the oligarchy or plutocracy under which we all live, that they pay homage to or fully sign up to the Council of Foreign Relations. Hence what its in-house journal, Foreign Affairs, says about the world we have to take seriously, whether we like it or not. And an article published last week by Alex Crowther, Jahara Matisek, and Phillips P. O'Brien is entitled Europe, but not NATO, should send troops to Ukraine. And they go on. Putin has apparently called the breakup of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, lamenting that tens of millions of our co-citizens and compatriots found themselves outside Russian territory. That statement is, of course, interpreted as indicative of his desire to reconquer that territory by military rather than economic and diplomatic means. The authors go on, the Baltic states are in danger, as is Poland. Last year, the former Russian prime minister and Putin loyalist Dmitry Medvedev described the Baltics as our, meaning Russian, provinces, and Poland as temporarily occupied, meaning by NATO. Medvedev is entitled to his opinion, of course, Dirk, as are these authors. But because the Russians may regard the Baltic states as ultimately Russian provinces, does that mean, because they are, in terms of culturally, historically, you know, socially, very closely allied to Russia, although they did suffer during the communist era, that doesn't necessarily mean that Russians want to invade, does it? Likewise, I can't help thinking that the temporary occupation of NATO by NATO of Poland is really just an objection to the military aspect of Poland's current position rather than, the intention of the Russians to somehow reconfigure their empire.
Yes, I think there's too much strong wording around, and that's not only Medvedev. It's also, if you listen to, don't forget that in the Baltic states, Russian language is forbidden now. There's a minority there. I also, on my trip there, I drove through and I talked to people in the border area who were from the Russian minority, and they were very bitter about what was going on. And even 2017, when I was there at a cafe, they had it was looking like preparation for war. You could see the strength of the Russian army and the strength of the Baltic States army on TV in 2017. So that's 5 years before the war broke out. And I'd like to mention what Putin said. This is often quoted as a proof that he's trying to revive the Soviet Empire. But what he in fact said, if you look into the original speech, is something that Germans can understand very well. When Germany was divided in East and West, that was a terrible situation for the families. And this is what happened after the breakup of the Soviet Union, that there were all kinds of problems for people who had lived together for a long time to simply go on in a normal life. Which is also true, by the way, for the Ukrainians and the Russians. There has always, you know, last year I've been in Belarus, and a lady said there, some of my relatives are in Ukraine. Some of my relatives are Ukrainian Ukrainians, and some are Russian Ukrainians, and I have Polish relatives. And it's a patchwork here in Eastern Europe. And it's just, the point was, she said, we should just keep peace. If somebody proposes war, please just run away. It was an elderly woman. And that is, so what Putin referred to with the biggest catastrophe is that it made life for a lot of people in the former Soviet Union very, very hard. And that is something I think can be understood what he meant. It's not meant in the terms of trying to revive an empire. And the rhetoric, if you go for Medvedev, and there have been others in Russia, where I would say it's going into obscene what they're stating. But as I said, there's no lack on the other side. It's not that you hear well-weighed words from Polish politicians. I know a guy from Germany who simply said in Poland that he thinks that the war was not unprovoked and could have been prevented. And these people are under legal. They could go to jail for that in Poland. So it's too much into that direction, and but a lot of people from the political sides are not standing on the brakes. And this is what you refer to, what happened in Germany. That is, in the last 20 years, it is, you know, we had this unbelievable chance of 1989 to create a new world. It was really the possibility. It was the possibility to abolish nuclear weapons. You had Gorbachev and Reagan. They were both heading towards that direction. And after that, this is something that, how I look at it, how was it possible to destroy this chance? It was really, I don't want to use the word, but it was beyond belief what happened to this political chance. And this is what, in a way, we should look at. And that is, for Germany, it's terrible, because all the things that had been achieved by, to a lesser degree, by the conservative government of Adenauer, than to a very high degree by the social democratic government in Germany, Brandt and Baar, who really managed to produce a different picture also in Eastern European countries about Germany. And it was heading into a good direction. And then Helmut Kohl, you could say the same about him. He was conservative chancellor, but he insulted Gorbachev and said, Gorbachev knows much about PR, as Goebbels did. He excused himself for that later on. And they became really not only friends, but buddies, you could say, Gorbachev and Kohl. So that was a close relationship. So all of that is out of the window, and I really don't know why. If you ask me, I don't know why. It's the same thing. I wondered why Britain hates Russia so much. And that is something I also don't understand. It's going on for decades.
I wonder about that. I wonder about that myself, to be perfectly honest. There have been all sorts of flare-ups over the years, diplomatic spats. Of course, England was very disappointed when Russia was awarded the World Cup, when we felt it was our turn, and responded by expelling a Russian diplomat, accusing him of being a spy. But there's a much more serious and deeper enmity that is supposed to go back, you know, all the way to the mid-19th century or earlier. Crimean War, people talk about for some reason. I should add, of course, that this certainly does not come from the British people at all, period. British people and the Russian people have no reason for any enmity between each other. Russia is a long way away. It's not like it's France just across the channel, with whom we fought wars on and off for hundreds of years in the Middle Ages. We have no reason for the Russians to be cast as our enemies. And yet talking heads on television and radio are unchallenged when they describe Russia as our enemy. And the same applies in the United States. I want to just sort of switch to a slightly more positive note. Polish President Andrzej Duda has dismissed the notion of an imminent military conflict in Europe, going against what Donald Tusk and others have said. Is there anybody in Germany who could be described as a beacon of sanity at the moment? Is there a single political party wanting a diplomatic solution to the situation imminently?
We currently, I would say, we only have one opposition party, and strangely enough, it's the right wing, AfD, who is in opposition towards this war path that we are walking on. That is, you know, I'm rather from that social democratic background, but I have to say that there's nothing like that strong enough in the social democratic party right now. And then there's some remnants of the left-wing party who are similar. And we have the biggest ray of hope that we have really is some these former military people like Harald Kujat and General Watt, who had been the advisor of Merkel. He came out publicly, and that is interesting. They all they complain about the role of the media. The media not trying to run between the ditches or the lines of battle with a white parliamentarian flag and telling the other side what the other side thinks or says, but taking a side. It's taking side and being a part. It's also like in World War One. We have been told for a long time that in Germany, the population was very eager to go to war. And we know now that it's not true. The people were very eager to go to war, were some part of the, let's say, part of the middle class, and especially the journalists were responsible for that. So that is a similar situation again to 1914. That we have right now. And you, Harald Kujat described that from the polls in Ukraine, that the Ukrainians want peace. And that is understandable because it's, as I said, it's a meat grinder. And they were simply, they will lose an enormous amount. They have lost already, and they will continue to lose as long as this war goes on, enormous amount of lives. And for what? In the end, that's if you if we talk about World War One, one of the points from John Keegan, a former British military historian, a famous one, and rightfully so, he said that one of the problems of World War One was that this enormous amount of young men that were sacrificed, and then for what? That you had to find some a good idea, and that led to nationalism and overstated. Beliefs where there was no, it was simply impossible to say that all these young men died in vain. They needed to attach meaning to their death, and that created the next problematic background, that it was they gave their lives for the nation, and we have to avenge them. So that is the problem there, and that's. If you look at that, so we have also Sarah Wagenknecht, a former member of the Left Party. They split, and she has a good chance to come into the parliament. But then it would, you know, how to make a decision? It would have to be the people from AfD voting with the left, people from the left together on this topic to get at least the chance of a real opposition. It would be parliamentary action, but both sides, I think there's not enough insight into that it would be necessary that they would really be doing. So we are in a locked situation. There's nothing really from the political side. There are people, and there's also another, you know, this is like the reason is coming from the strange figures. We have one of the oldest feminist journalists in Germany, Ali Schwarzer, who's, for example, gave the stage to Sarah Wagenknecht and General Watt and Kujat and other people like that to voice their concerns. It's a group of the elderly people, except for Sarah Wagenknecht, who is about 50 or so. It's like elderly people. And from the young, this generation of the 40, we have a lot of female ministers of defense in Europe. Yeah? And they are somehow, they all of them were against war. There were a ton of them were conscientious objectors if they were male, and now they discovered their inner soldier somehow, and they all wanted in return they wanted to go to the military, and they missed the chance, and now they are eager to go into that direction. It's hard to understand for me what I see there, but if you ask me if there's a chance and from the political side I just described, there's nothing else. So it's a weird situation. We would need a coalition of the right-wing party and the left-wing party in German parliament.
I think the same applies across Europe. It's extraordinary, really, how the center, or the so-called center, has become the militaristic, authoritarian, even, dare I say, quasi-fascist, anti-free speech warmonger party, that isn't lumping in too many characteristics in the same breath. But I don't think that's an unfair description, Dirk.
There's a kind of totalitarianism of the middle. I don't know how else to name it. It is from these
neoliberal neoliberal fascism.
Yeah, it is, and it is one of the problems is that, for example, they don't think they become good by doing good things, but they are good, and what they do will be good because it's from them, and there are no limits, no breaks. They go against free speech because it's only important that they can speak. They are the good ones. So if it's only them, then we will hear good things and the others have to be silenced. And that is detrimental, of course. That is not the essence of democracy. And they are pouring acid on the foundations of that. And this is coming from the people in the middle. This is real. And so it's a decline. The reason why we have freedom of speech is not that it's so nice to be tolerant, but because Europe has understood in 2,500 years since the Agora in Athens that this is the way that we can get forward. If we listen to the other side and we have quarrels, but democracy is not about having all the same opinion, but that we can quarrel in a civilized way and then come to not a common agreement, but rather a deal that you can make, that it's possible to deal between each other. And that has to be trained. It has to be, I think, taught at schools, taught at universities, and that somehow left. And now we have people who think that they are the good ones and they should be in power. And now even up to the point where interior intelligence services are, as in Germany now, brought against people. If you delegitimize the state, that is a new definition, which I always do because I'm a journalist. That's my topic as a journalist. And then you are become a victim of the interior intelligence services in Germany. It's come up to that. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's, you know, that's Stasi level, isn't it? Let's face it.
It is. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break with the network now. When we come back, I want to look again at this article in Foreign Affairs, which suggests that if European troops remain west of the Dnieper River, they will not provoke World War III. And also the green shoots that we're seeing in the United States of the widespread anti-war movement, and asking Dirk, is there any chance that the young people of Germany and the rest of Europe might wake up to the real danger that they face? We'll be right back after this short break.
My name's Stacy, I'm 57, and I was adopted in 2020.
We were adopted in 2019.
And we were adopted in 2021.
We had a house, and it sounds crazy, but it wasn't a home. The one thing that Jake and Emma brought is it became a home.
When I met Dakota, he had just turned 14.
You weren't there for the first this and the first that. I missed the first words, but we got a lot of other firsts.
Watching her say, oh my God, I cannot believe I got my license. And she's like, I passed. And I'm like, girl.
See them grow. It is.
They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
You and you.
Kids in the middle.
What I thought was a complete life was nowhere near complete. But it is now.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward.
Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, in for Patrick tonight. I must admit, I'm thoroughly enjoying my conversation with the very erudite Dirk Polman, and I hope you are too. And before we move on to just how European troops might be deployed in Ukraine without provoking World War III, in the opinion of the writers at Foreign Affairs, I just want to pick up on what Dirk was saying before the break about deals and how they are essential to diplomacy, and indeed how diplomacy appears to have been trashed in the last 5 years. Any kind of conversation with the enemy is regarded as appeasement, with ludicrous comparisons to 1938, 1939, and Hitler. What on earth has happened to quite simply the standard of international dialogue, Dirk? It seems to me that the likes of China, the global South, South Africa, one or two other countries are the only people, you know, genuinely interested in not just paying lip service to this garbage about a rules-based international order that suits the United States and its allies, you know, but generally trying to maintain the international relations that are supposed to avoid all-out war.
Yes, very much so. That is a very interesting topic. When I see that, I remember Jeffrey Sachs, when he was talking about the people who have high positions in China. They, in China, if you get into that position, you have to have proven that you're able to reign a large area. So he was saying a lot of them, when he's talking to them, they are very educated, and a lot of them have been my students, he said. And that in general, and just if you take Ukraine, there was a Chinese envoy, and he tried to find a possibility to restart the peace talks. And the proposal is really a sound one. They said, we just start where we stopped, where you stopped in May of 2022. And then did as if nothing happened and try, because that was a situation that was for both sides, it was possible. And this is why they had already agreed on a peace treaty. That was Boris Johnson coming from Great Britain, but it was not only him. It was the idea was that militarily the West could get into a better situation. And they thought Ukraine had been trained by Western powers from the military side for a long time, and they were confident that they would win. And what we saw in the last years and the last decades is that really there's not much reason to think that the Western military is in a different situation than the Soviet military in the 70s, a hypertrophic state of too much money going into this arms deals there. And was in the Soviet Union, of course, it was not a business, but it has always been in the West. And this is from the, so the Chinese proposed that. And there are other countries, if you listen to the speech of the South African foreign minister in the Gaza war, and that was the highlight from the speeches that I heard at that time. So I think in a way, we could say that if there is a possibility, it's probably not from the West, which is in decline, but from other states who are now rising. And then even China, it has, I mean, I don't know how they will be when they are the big ones. If they are the 400-pound gorilla, we'll have to see how they behave then. But we know how other nations behaved. And in the magazine that I sent you, which is History in Focus, there's also a lecture from Alfred de Sayas, one of the foremost international rights specialist. He had been working for the United Nations, and he's now lecturing in Switzerland. And if you listen to him, then they are pulling out their hair all the time. For example, for the bombing of the consulate in Syria by the Israelis. That is something that hadn't happened for, I think, the last that was one of the outcomes of the 30 years war in Europe, that you had these embassies, and even Pinochet or whoever, they didn't attack at no time was an embassy attacked. And that's for a good reason. It's not because, again, we are so nice, but no diplomacy will work if this isn't in. This has to be abided, and we have to sanction it if it goes away. And we are not, so the West that is talking about rules-based order is not the ones who keep the international law upright. And it is, we are in a pitiful situation. We're losing credibility fast. The politics is losing credibility in the population. The media is losing credibility in the population. You can see that. The German population, for example, in 70-80% want a good relationship with Russia. They are more reasonable than the politicians. And it's, again, hard to understand why you have these people who have death wish in politics. I don't know how else I should call that. That is something that, and if they are young people, not really. If you go to demonstrations, there are few people, and they are rather elderly, rather my age or older. The people who watch German public TV, where we always had the joke when I was working there that this the advertisement is for artificial teeth, glue sticking to the gum, because that's the same age group. We called it Cookie Dent TV, yeah, because that's the famous brand in Germany. So there's nothing that is not the same as when I was a student. There was a huge peace movement at that time, and it was there was support from many intellectuals, from people, educated people. It was, and they were driving. They were able to be on top of the events and giving the agenda that was discussed. Nothing like that at all, and that's another thing. I think we even might be missing the correct soundtrack for the feeling that there is something that, because a lot of that is that you have a feeling that there something else is possible. It's not intellectual. It's rather coming from the heart. And that is missing today completely. It's the feeling is that 40% of the German population, a poll said, that they are careful what they say because you cannot say what you think anymore. We are at that stage. You know?
Wow. I mean, I thought that would have gone by the wayside, but, you know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fact that that kind of self-censorship has re-emerged so soon, only 30 years later, is absolutely extraordinary. What about the Nord Stream pipeline destruction, sabotage, terrorism, which has brought genuine hardship to German industry and yes, the economy? What do most German people think about it? Do they blame? Are they not up in arms? I don't get it.
It's something very strange. In the beginning, we were told, and that was internationally, that was not only Germany, that it was Putin who blew up himself in the pipeline.
That's right.
And that, of course, is it's so dumb that I don't even want to discuss it. The next thing that happened was Seymour Hersh coming up with the article, and that that was a watershed event. So they had to declare Seymour Hersh a case of dementia. Kind of, they talked about him like we should talk about Joe Biden. That was how they painted the picture. And then from there on, we had TV reporting started in Germany that was on the news, and it was not anymore the great enigma what happened, but it was, oh, we have evidence that there's a sailing boat and six people who went with amateur equipment down and exploded. They cut the explosives on the table of that sailing boat, and then they blew it up. And it was some Ukrainians. There's a guy in charge who has a background in special forces in Ukraine. That's what we were told. But he worked without the knowledge of the government in Ukraine, because then you would have a problem. Why send weapons to the country that blew up your pipeline? And it's really, in effect, one of the reasons that the German economy is it's in a terrible. We are the worst country in Europe, meanwhile, in terms of economic development. So we are the sick man of Europe. Can you imagine that? That's a direct outcome from this. So how would you sell that to the public? And now it is there had been some alternative information that was coming. For example, we published in the magazine where I'm chief editor, we published that this is factual. There's no discussion about it, that American planes were circling and monitoring the area before that, and even exactly within the time frame. So it is a coordinated thing. There's pre-knowledge. And how do you bring this together with some Ukrainian rogue persons who blow up the pipeline? But in effect, it is. Then you have this investigations, which is Denmark, Sweden, and Germany.
Yes.
And Sweden is the country of ridiculous investigations. They, if you want a completely stalled investigation, go to Sweden. They have never. It is Estonia, the Palme murder, and now the pipeline. They started out with the their focus of their research was if there was Swedish equipment used or Swedish people involved in the blow up, and they found out no. And then they said we have an idea who it could have done it, but these people are outside of our jurisdiction, so we close our investigation. That is a very brave statement. It could, I mean, that is ridiculous to the point that I don't know. And then they Denmark more or less the same, and that doesn't point towards Russia. You could say if Russia, if the country that they thought would do it would be Russia, we would probably hear a little bit more about the investigation. And then it all now goes to Germany, and you will hear nothing from Germany. Remember that Scholz was standing next to Biden when Biden announced that. The pipeline wouldn't survive if there would be an attack from Russia on Ukraine. So it was it's a sabotage, the biggest one in the history of terrorist act, even bigger in terms of the damage done, not of the lives lost than 9/11, but in the damage and also in the outcome, what came from it. I mean, 9/11 was a moral situation. It was about morale, really. And had a different effect, and it was possible to go to war, but for Germany with Nord Stream, it's a devastating effect on the economy since then, and everything else that followed goes with it. And I think I have to say that the German population doesn't fully understand it, because there's no reports on it. It's not part of the media. It should be discussed in the media.
It should be front and center. Indeed, there have been developments in the last couple of weeks. I don't know if you heard that Nord Stream is seeking more than 400 million euros, which
Lloyds,
strikes me.
That is the big thing. I mean,
yes,
that is,
that's right.
No from reporting on that in German media and the mainstream media. No reporting on that. Lloyd said we will not pay because it was done by a state actor. It's not an act of terrorism. It's an act of war. That is the argument. Very interesting. And they have to go to court and prove it. But it's not reported in Germany.
Yeah. Right. Well, that almost tells us everything we need to know. What's going to be very interesting, of course, is in their defense, they're going to have to name the country, surely. They can't simply say this was an act of war because the degree of sophistication of munitions used, the scale of the operation means that only a state actor could have carried it out, and leave it suspended in midair as to who that state actor is. They must have to name that state actor and produce a bit more evidence than that, surely.
Right. Right. And it is that's a point where you all again can say that what kind of media system are we living in, where these things are it's the emperor's new clothes? Is there the same? So this is what's going on there. You're not allowed to say what everybody knows, and it's becoming a problem. Yeah, but we're running out of time now.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Dirk Polman. Regular contributor to TNT. Where can people find your writings and research?
But it's mostly in German. Yeah, that's my next.
We can use Google Translate. We can use Google Translate.
Okay, 321 Orc. That is one of them. But we just take articles from other people. But look at my documentaries. Okay, 20 seconds. Look at my documentaries. Most of them are available in English, and I will upload them again. They have been aired in more than 30 countries before they've been
Fantastic.
Taken off.
And we'll have you on again very soon. I can't thank you enough for your contribution tonight, Dirk. There he goes. That's Dirk Polman. We'll be right back.